We want to talk now about being precious intellectually. And this is one of the two areas of all the talks that I'm going to have the most difficulty with, because I know from what I've read that in a fairly big way I'm not like a lot of people in the program. I have no memories of ever being put down for my thinking. I want to share first my own background on this. Now, I would always be put down for my doing. I could never do anything to please my mother or my dad. I still to this day can't do any work supervised. If you give me a job, leave the room. Because if you stay around, it's going to be this authority figure still present hovering over me that I could never please. But all my grandparents were born in Europe. They all came over in the late 1890s or early 1900s. My mother's parents were, my mom's dad was a coal miner. My father's dad was a farmer, a very small farm with a large family, so there was a lot of poverty. My mother quit school in the fourth grade, my dad in the 11th grade. My dad worked in the mines. My mother couldn't get any job after she worked in a factory. My dad felt he worked in the mines because that was all he could do. And so unlike a lot of people, when I started first grade or kindergarten even, I knew that kindergarten ended with college. It was never discussed. I mean, it was the one point, just the way most people today, from good families, you go to first grade and you graduate from high school. In our family, you went to first grade and you graduated from college, and that was how the block went, and it had nothing less to it. I had only one talk with my dad that was good. And I have like two authority figures. Let me come into this because it might help you. I have my mother, and to get my mother's love, I have to be who she wanted me to be. And then the talk I had with my dad, he told me why we were going to college, all of us. And he said that he had to work the mines because it was the only thing he could do. And he looked at me and he said, this was between my junior and my senior year at Penn State. He said, I don't care what you do. I don't care if you work in the mines beside me next year. I don't care if you lay brick. I don't care if you teach. I don't care if you're a lawyer. He never included the priesthood. I didn't think he wanted any of his sons to go that wrong. But anyway, he said, but I want you to do what you do because you want to do it. And basically, what I learned that day is he wanted me to be the best me I could be. In my life, I have had two major organizations. I've had the Catholic Church, that unfortunately the institution I had to deal with. And this institution has asked me to sacrifice myself for its good. That's what my mother did. I was supposed to sacrifice me for the sake of the church, take assignments that were poor, be in bad places, never question, never ask. And then against that, I've had Alcoholics Anonymous. And translate this to ACA or CODA or Al-Anon or whatever organization you're in. And I know that when I come to an AA meeting and I'm sitting there, that what AA wants is for me to be the best me I could be. The same wish that my father had. So the church, in a sense, represented my mother's view. My mother wanted me to sacrifice myself for her. That's what I was there for. AA represents my father's view. And inside me, when I go to do the second and the third steps or meditating, I have these two competing images of God also. One, that a lot of people have told me, I have a God who wants me to sacrifice myself for him. And then I have the second, a God who sacrifices himself so that I can be the best me I could be. But I got to struggle, and unfortunately, I'm sure some of you weren't blessed the way I was with a father who at least had the other view. And you never felt anything of the second view until you came to the program. And so when you translate to God, I would really say that, you know, if your church is one where you see yourself as sacrificing for the church, and behind that is a God that has the same view. My whole understanding of Christianity is that God did everything for us. Christianity is the only religion that has a God who doesn't ask for anything. The Son of Man has not come to be served, but to serve. And we forget that. You know, I tell the people, if you're here to give something to God today, you're not listening to Jesus. He doesn't want anything from you. He doesn't need anything from you. He's begged you to come here today so he can do something for you. And that is the God of Christianity. It also solidly, of course, is the power that we have in the program. One of the neatest things, if you're new in the program, I heard this said, and it's such a beautiful thing. We don't want anything from you. We want the privilege of being able to do something for you. We want to take the acceptance we found and give it to you. We want to take the love that we know and share it with you. And that's so wonderful and just so free. But anyway, at home, I started off going to school to go all the way through college. I started school real early. My mother wanted me out of the house. I was 5 in July and started first grade in July. I mean, in September. 5 in July, started first grade in September. So I graduated from high school at 16 and college at 20, never skipping a grade. I don't know if that's the reason, but I was a C student in grammar school. And the one neat thing is, I don't ever remember being put down for that. I must have been. I could not have been as good as my brother and sister who made the honor roll all the time. But I remember at the spring of my sixth year, all of a sudden getting excited at ancient history when we were studying it, getting turned on by it and having all the right answers, and being pleased by how the nun kept calling on me and how happy she was that I had all the right answers. And so I went then into junior high. I was a B student. High school, I was an AB student, and I have 12 years of college, almost all straight A's, above how I turn out intellectually when I'm tested. I want to go back, and I'm trying to give you little things that over the years I've gleaned. As I told you, I like experience in the program. So sometimes I can share my own experience with you. And listening to Fifth Steps, I've noticed that an awful lot of people, they'll have one pattern till puberty, and they pick up a second pattern from puberty on. And that's the one we basically stay with. They'll usually come up with reasons like this was happening, my parents were fighting, or this was happening. But I just see that really the basic molds that we're going to live with, we settle into sometimes in puberty. We can start them earlier and go right with them. We can be kind of introvertish or a positive stroker. A better one would be, I know several people have been negative strokers as young kids, getting into trouble for attention. But all of a sudden in puberty, they switch over, and the rest of their life, they're out, they're positive strokers. If it happened for you, it's just sort of a real standard thing. Now, neither my mother nor my father knew anything about the academic world. You know, they both quit school so early. They felt totally empty here, so I had absolute full freedom to think. I love thinking, and I love to try to simplify it. I love preaching. I love thinking about Christianity and making it simpler and simpler and simpler. Same thing with the program, finding this God and making it simpler and simpler and simpler. All this may sound complex to you, but everything I'm saying, honestly, is ultimately simple. All of these talks, with all of the blabbing and everything else, is basically to tell you are one, you are precious as one, and it is crucial for you that you know you are precious as one, that you love every part of who you are. That's the whole mold of what I'm trying to do this weekend, because that's how I experience it in my mind and trying to experience it in my life. So in the academic world, I was free to think. Outside of this world, no thought of mine was ever appreciated at home, was ever asked for, was ever encouraged. I could do nothing right at home for my mother or my dad. Therefore, I have supreme confidence when thinking and no confidence when doing. I'm almost like one of these academics. Now, this doesn't deal with counseling, because that was a different area. I feel very good here. But I don't know where to put the... I had a car for 100,000 miles. That's 2.5 years for me. And never knew where the water went or the oil went. Now, I've learned the best way to handle things like this is to laugh about it. I was talking to my best friend, who's a mechanical genius, and talking about a knock in the car. He says, you know how to handle that, don't you? So I said, yeah, you pick up the phone, you dial the garage, they come get the car, they bring it back, and it's fixed. And I'm going to laugh at it. You know, just, that's me. I would die in a world of real living. I don't know anything about farming in a very practical, real way. I try to show an interest and an appreciation, since I'm in rural parishes, for what the farmers do. But I'm not going to become a farmer. I don't know anything about painting, plumbing, carpentry, electrician. Screwing a screw in is a major accomplishment for me. I just do that. Jay, I'm so happy. You know, I've done something. I'm doing a little bit. I'll try little things like this. I don't want to stay totally useless in this world. But see, I was chopped down in that world. But well, I'm getting into this where I'm not like a lot of people. I was never chopped down in the world of pure thought. My experience in reading tells me I'm very different from a lot of us in the room right now. A lot of you were called stupid. You were insulted. Your thinking was put down. And I sense for people who have this how very, very, very strongly they react to those labels today. One of my closest friends who cares for my dogs without ever taking anything every time I'm gone, the hint of the word that she's stupid just upsets her so much. And yet if she wants to insult someone, the first word she'll use on them is, he's stupid. And I can hear that as a kid, her mind was constantly denigrated in a sense like this, put down, insulted, you don't have the right to think. And the sadly thing about this is that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I tell you you're stupid, you're going to act like you're stupid, and you're not going to know the power of your own mind. And see, it's very important for us to know how precious we are in our minds intellectually. This is the start of our unique dignity. We can think. We can collect facts. We can form opinions about them. We can test our opinions. We can reverse them. We can revise them. We can also reason. See, that's what they call inductive reasoning. You gather a lot of facts, and then you reach some conclusions. Deductive reasoning says, you know, all dogs have four legs, or, well, Huggins says, all dogs wag tails. One of my dogs, Ume, that's a Japanese for plum blossom, because the gal who takes care of my dogs is Japanese. Ume is a dog, therefore she wags a tail. That's deductive reasoning. We can reason both ways. That enables us to create civilizations. It enables us, one of my ordination cards, and I like it so much because it has so much more meaning for the program. It's, from your shoulders, I have seen a new horizon. Thank you. And that's, we can learn because we can think. Each generation does not have to learn by itself anew. The human mind allows me to hear what you have learned and to grow from it and to pass it on. You know, we share our body and our feelings with all other animals. And one of the sad things is a lot of people put their religion on that level. Religion has something to do with feeling holy. And being holy means you do not feel guilty. That's terrible for shame-based people, incidentally, because I couldn't confuse feeling guilty and feeling shame-based, and I'd never feel like I belong in church. I don't know how many good people don't go to church because they feel guilty. And what I try to tell them is you share feelings with animals. Pigs have feelings. And God certainly has not put his relationship with us on the area where we share with pigs. He's put it on the area of our mind and our will, that which makes us uniquely us. And how sad it is if we weren't given a grasp of how precious we are in this area of our being. As I try to do with all these, I want to list some of the obstacles you and I have today to knowing that we're precious intellectually. And the first comes from a television. Most of us are, well, we split. Some of us are younger, some of us are older. I grew up in a television generation already, also part of the radio generation. And there's a big difference. Television, you're just a passive spectator. You don't have to think at all. You just sit there and be. Couch potatoes. Radio, you had to use your mind. I think I was using this, was it at St. Elizabeth that I use? I once answered the phone. I got a good sense of humor, I think. Answered the phone saying, Duffy's, answer the phone, Duffy's Tavern, Duffy ain't in. This is Archie the manager speaking. And it was my bishop calling, unfortunately. But if you remember Duffy's Tavern, that was the old line. In the radio, you filled out. You had to think. You had to fill out the scene. And it's so much more active that at least part of a person would be alive. Secondly, we have an anti-intellectual streak in our program today. You'll hear speaker after speaker in AA brag about the fact that everything I pass on, I've received from someone else. I have not added anything. And I think about it, how sad. God didn't just give me a memory. He gave me a mind. And if all I'm doing is passing on what I have received, then the only thing that's active is my memory. I'm very proud that what I share with you often has not come from anyone else. That I am able to think about the heritage given me and maybe get new viewpoints and pass it on from new slants. And in case you think this is offensive, if you're going to be a fundamentalist big booker, let me tell you, the big book says more will constantly be revealed to us. And if all I'm doing is passing on to you what I've received, then I'm not enriching the heritage and I'm not open to more being constantly received. I get one of my deepest thrills is a new insight, if I can share it with someone in religion or in the program, when I see things in a new and a simpler way. This anti-intellectual streak can be masqueraded. Very early in the program, people delight in reading. They look for books like I've put out here. They want to read about alcoholism. They want to read about adult children. They want to read about codependency. But basically what they read about is just conference-approved literature. Now that's good, and I need that, but it's all safe. And what you really have, if you look at a lot of these people, there's no desire to expand their mind. There's actually a fear of new ideas. If you're in ACA and AA, I think you can identify with just looking at AA. It's going to happen to ACA sooner or later. It happens to all these. What happens is people mock new ideas. They don't want to hear about ACA problems in AA. They'll mock the term codependent. And I'm listening to conference speakers that I respect do this in areas, and I feel sad when they do this. Codependent. How do I share somebody else's dependency? They don't understand the term. They won't look the term up. They laugh at a term they don't understand. New ideas are discouraged and put down. If you've been to a lot of AA meetings, I think the blue card is an attempt to do this. I think possibly the blue card that's read at meetings is the saddest thing that has happened in AA's literature, and the most dangerous. They have this card that says, this is an open meeting, so you're all welcome here, but if you share, we ask that whatever you say be confined to alcoholism. And then you turn it over, this is a closed meeting, it's for alcoholics only, and if you share here, we ask that whatever you say be confined to alcoholism. That opens the door to censorship. Now, if I'm an alcoholic, and I am, everything I do applies to my alcoholism. Everything. If my codependency flips out, if I go into my overeating, I'm going to hate myself that much sooner or later. I'm likely to drink again. If I'm shame-based and don't handle my being shame-based, if I don't handle my ACA issues, I'm going to drink again. The first time this happened in AA in a big way was with drugs. We don't want any talk about drugs. And I used to have something think this is the whole AA big book. I'd want to go to a club like this. The AA thing is not intended for this, so I've never done it. My sponsor would kill me if I did it for that reason. But I wanted to go to a group that said you couldn't talk about drugs and give my life. And as I was talking, I'd have a lot of paper clips in the big book and go to those pages and just rip them out. As I was talking, just rip pages out of the big book. And just keep talking. And when I was finished saying, I understand you don't want any reference to drugs, I've just pulled every page from the big book that has a reference to drugs. Here's your big book. Because they're mentioned in the book. If they're mentioned, they're part of my life. How can I not mention it? Well, God put them in my life. I'm not going to censor my talk to suit someone else. Now, if I'm talking to alcoholics and all I do is talk drugs or ACA, I'm not talking the language they need to hear. I've got to bring this in. It's part of my life. But if my purpose should be to carry the message to help these people, I'm going to talk on the area that I can identify with these people. If I can speak French, and I can't, I've got a mental block on languages. I've studied 6, got A's in all of them, and can't talk anything. Flush them all out. It's a big mental block. But supposing I could speak French, German, Russian, and English, and I come here and I talk Russian, do I want to help you? If I can talk alcoholism, drug addiction, ACA, and overeating, and this is a group of alcoholics, and I talk ACA or overeating, do I want to help you? I don't really want to carry the message to you. So the good sponsorship will correct this, but the danger is of censoring. And what happens? Why don't alcoholics want drugs mentioned? Because they all can't identify. But nobody can identify with anything. Supposing one of you, I don't like even talking this, it's so, supposing somebody has a husband who divorced them, I'll take a safe one, and they come crushed to a meeting. He just walked out. He had an affair and walked out, and she was blindsided. And she's just devastated. I'm not going to look at her and say, well, you know, I'm not married. You can't talk about that. We all can't identify with marriage. Or somebody has problems with the children. I don't have any children that I know of, so we can't talk about that. Okay? The only thing we have, all of us, in common is we drank alcohol, not even commercial alcohol. So we'd all have to say, I drank alcohol, I drank alcohol, I drank alcohol, and that'd be 60 minutes of that. We allow all these other topics that everybody can't identify with, but one little topic, the D word, drugs, we're not going to talk about. And now some AA speakers are getting violent on adult children issues. One of my best friends, who I respect dearly, is violent on this. We're going to have a confrontation. She allows it in me, but not in other speakers. And we're going to be on a program together, and she's going to be shocked. And it's because we're going to have to really talk about this a little bit. You can't talk about this. You can't talk about this. You know, they talk about blaming the parents. I'm going to take full responsibility. If they just saw, you know, there's such a blindness to this. It's like saying that when they shut this down, I'm fully responsible for myself. I'm not. You ever talk to somebody who's been molested sexually? Talk to somebody who at the age of 2 or 3 or 4 becomes gay and then tell them they got to take full responsibility for this. How? I'm not getting anywhere in this, but the most dramatic life I've heard was a gal who at the age of 3 wanted to become a prostitute, at the age of 14 became one. And when she sobered up, the biggest guilt she carried were for those tricks that she cheated because she couldn't give them a full value because she was drunk. Now, her mother was a prostitute. And when she was growing up and her mother was functioning, the guys would be nice to her. They'd expect a little bit better. And there was money. Every so often, her mother would marry, probably shack up with a guy. And the guys who will shack up, unfortunately, often with a functioning prostitute, aren't very respectful. And they'd slap the girl around. There'd be no money. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, this girl makes an identification. Prostitution is happiness. Marriage is misery. So she became a prostitute. Now, to tell her she was responsible completely for it, she never married. In the program, she stopped being a prostitute and ended up found God and meditated and everything. But to tell her she was responsible for all this, that's silly. I mean, it's blind. It's blind to so much of reality. And what's happening in the program, we're putting down what we fear because there's this anti-intellectualism. One of the most important rules, comes somewhere else in the notes, but I'll talk about it now. One of the most important lines I know in the Bible is in 1 John. Love drives out fear. I think that was Pope Paul the 23rd, or whatever it was. Was he the one, the big one? The Vatican Council Pope. Big, 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 hefty, happy. Love drives out fear. The other side of that is also, unfortunately, equally true. It's not in the Bible, but fear drives out love. And when we start putting up walls and you can't talk about this and you can't mention that and I'm going to shut you down because you're not talking about what I think you should, then we're starting censoring talks and there's so much danger can come into the program. And it's a very deadly thing. Who decides? If I'm whole, everything affects my alcoholism. People want only safe talks. The human mind, staying in this same area, really isn't valued much in AA. People say something true and draw a dangerous conclusion. They say, my best thinking got me here. The conclusion then is that all of my thinking is wrong. That's not valid. My best thinking got me here, therefore I am not the best person to oversee what is good or bad for me, but it does not mean that my mind is bad. I really am a very good sponsor and counselor. I have a sense for people when I work my own 8th and 9th step. And I can be alive to their feelings and see what they need. I am absolutely blind in my own life. The image I like to use, it's like I watch the people I sponsor running full speed off a cliff shouting, "Ain't the view grand?" And I got to pull them by the collar and say, "Back up." I've watched my own sponsor do it, running right off a cliff and enjoying the view. And I wonder, why am I the only person who can enjoy the view safely? And I feel a tug. That's my sponsor pulling me back. We are blind about ourselves. I mean, I can see the patterns in you instantly and absolutely miss them at the same time I'm seeing them in you, that I've got them in me. But all my thinking isn't wrong. Again, this is an echo of many fundamental churches, including streams of Catholicism, where the mind is viewed as dangerous. You might think wrong, and that's certainly true. Therefore, don't think at all. That's not true. You might think wrong. That's a risk God took. Blame God. Don't shut down the thinking. Because not to think strips us of our own unique dignity. I was going to end with this. I think it's somewhere on here. I'm going to pull it up much higher. I have this picture of the judgment where you come before God and God says, okay, you did this. And you say, well, I was Catholic and the Pope told us to. And God says, I was asking you, why did you do this? Well, I was Catholic and the Pope told me to. And God said, maybe you don't understand. I'm not talking to the Pope. I'm talking to you. When the Pope is here, I'm going to ask him why he did this. But right now I'm asking you why you did this. Well, I'm Catholic and the Pope told me to. Maybe you're not understanding me. I didn't just give the Pope a mind. I gave you a mind. And when you surrendered your mind to the Pope, you became an animal. See, it's the mind that makes you human. Now, please don't send this to Rome. If you properly... Vatican Council said this. Vatican Council says that every Christian has a duty to follow his or her own conscience. If your conscience says that there's a better church than the Catholic Church, the Vatican Council says you should leave the Catholic Church. It risks thinking wrong in order to kind of see the dignity of the human mind. It also says we have a duty to form our conscience, to do correct thinking. And in that, I listen to what the Pope says and I try to hear his reasons and weigh it. The Pope is someone who speaks with a certain amount of religious maturity and I should hear this. But I don't surrender my mind to do what he says. That's not human. That's not Christian. It's really not truly, fully Catholic in that sense. So we have AA kind of often putting the mind down. We have a lot of religions doing it. And we Americans tend to be very practical people. We don't appreciate thinking at all. It's more what we do. I was having a meeting for young adults in a parish, and a mother of 12 kids who was between 55 and 65 years old came up and asked, when do you stop being young? And I said, when you stop being open. And I really believe that. See, in life there is only openness and growth and being closed and shrinking and dying. I know teenagers who are old. They come from closed systems of thinking. They're not responsible. This is how it is, and everything, the rest of their life, their whole thinking is going to be inside that box, unless some trauma makes them throw it open. They're old. It's so neat. Catherine's here. She heard me. Now, if you want to see what being young is, take a look at Catherine. Heard a talk on these ideas at St. Elizabeth two or three afternoons ago, liked the idea, wanted to see about more, and so she's coming here. She's open to growth. If you're here, you're young. And at least part of your life, you're open. But when I stop bringing in new, then I'm closed. It's a closed system and I'm old. Okay, so those are some of the obstacles. It's so crucial that we see our minds, our intellects, as precious. And for some of you, that means you're going to have to go back and reverse your childhood tapes. Try to do some thinking that God gave me this mind. And God sees it as precious. Picture yourself and a pig or a dog. Picture yourself as an animal that's bigger or stronger. What gives you your dignity? It's your mind. How valued God sees it and how much God wants you to use it. God wants me to use it. Now, let me go on from this. When I think I'm going to make mistakes, God had a choice between freedom and perfection. God chose freedom. God could have had all of us be perfect just by not making us free. Our ACA CODA values tell us that's what we should be. But it's not the value God picked. God had a choice in which way the universe would be better, making us all perfect or making us all free. You know, I got to conclude from that one proper free act is better than being perfect. One proper free act somehow made it all worthwhile for God. It's not all proper free acts. It's just one. You and I have the opposite value. We've got to be perfect all the time. I will absolutely damn myself for anything less than perfection. That's one of the tapes I have, the one I got from my mother. Anything I do, I have to do right, and even then I'm not going to be good enough. So anything less than perfect. I give a talk. If I don't like the talk, I can just, I want to throw a suicide party. Right away, you know, just said something I shouldn't have or didn't say something I wanted to. If I start regurgitating the talk in my mind, boy, I'm ready to wipe myself out. Because that tape will run. Something else that occurred to me in reading the Gospels, Jesus had another choice. See, God is both truth and love. Now, Jesus had a choice between preferring truth to love. And there is absolutely no doubt about it, he chose love. Read the Gospels cover to cover, and you won't ever see somebody being rejected because they think wrong. Jesus never turns his back on somebody because they think wrong. He just goes right on loving. Something that would shatter people of religion, if they ever paid attention to it, is the great last judgment scene in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is judging the nations. That's very important. Nations are non-Jews. These are the pagans. And he's going to separate them into the sheep and the goats. Now notice how this shatters just about everything you've ever been taught. He doesn't put anybody on the side of the goats because they weren't baptized. He doesn't put anybody on the side of the goats. These are the pagan nations now because they didn't believe in him or know his name. Really doesn't put anybody there because they broke the Ten Commandments. How does he separate? Whether they're loving or not. I believe religion is reality. And I believe what happens later must be valid now or it isn't real. And Jesus is saying, you can know peace without being baptized. And I know hundreds of alcoholics who shine with the peace of God and they don't know anything about baptism. You can know peace and break the commandments. I have friends who live in delightful sin. I used to visit this couple that weren't married, and I was the best man at their wedding, and I told them it was disgusting they were getting married because I couldn't come down and stay with them and enjoy their sinful living. But I mean, you know, both of them, that was kidding on that part, but both of them really knew real serenity. But I have never seen anybody who stops working with other people who keeps the light in their eyes. I was hungry. And you gave me to eat. No peace. Come into the kingship prepared for you by my Father. I had a need. I was hurting, and you shared yourself. I was lonely, and you visited me. And so you know peace now. And on the other side, I know sincere religious people who think right, who have been baptized, pray to Jesus, and they're miserable as hell. Because they can spend the time in church and never visit people who are lonely. Never go to a hospital. Sometimes because they think what they're doing isn't important. I was lonely. You visited me. And it was so neat. You came visiting me even when you didn't feel you're making any progress. And how neat that was. That's where you get peace from. Jesus picked love over truth. For 2,000 years, almost every church has picked truth over love. If you don't think right, get out. If you don't believe our creed, go somewhere else. Anathema sit. That was the great message that the bishops would use in councils when they would let them be damned. Let them be damned if they don't think this way. Well, that certainly doesn't in its own way echo the heart of Jesus. They're trying to help us. There's a positive side to that. But I want to just point that out. So first, it's okay to think. It's okay to think wrong. God picked freedom over perfection, and Jesus never, never rejects anybody who thinks wrong. He goes right on loving them. So does the program. You come to the program, you got dumb thoughts, we'll tolerate you, we'll pat you on the head. We may not listen to you. but we accept you for who you're at. I want to now tell you, some of you were at the ACA meeting, you heard this already. I'm going to tell you maybe one of the, possibly the most important thing you're going to hear all weekend. Anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. Okay? I did not say that wrong. I heard that about 4 years ago at an AA meeting and almost knocked me off my chair. Told you I was raised with the opposite tape. Anything worth doing, I got to do perfectly. Even then, I'm not going to be good enough because I'm flawed inside. So you know how I do things first? Before I do anything, I take the lesson. Read the manual. I just got some new software for a computer, and I'm reading the manuals. I got a Nintendo set for my rectory so the high school kids could play. First thing I do, they play the game. They put the thing in, they start running it. I read the rules on everything. Take lessons, read the rules so you'll be perfect, because if you don't do it perfectly, you're no good. I mean, that was the rule of my family, that I felt inside. I'm just astounded that some people just go ahead and they do it. Most people I know, the real computer people, they get a new software, they don't read anything, just put it in and start fooling around. But they don't know the rules. How could they be doing it? And then I heard this guy say, anything worth doing is worth doing poorly, and my life was turned around, and it became so real and so excellent. See, before this, if I didn't have time to do a perfect 10-step, I wouldn't do any 10-step. If I didn't have time to do a perfect meditation, I wouldn't do a meditation. If I wasn't going to give the Sermon on the Mount, I wouldn't preach. And a lot of these things I cheated myself. Now I've learned that a poor inventory is better than no inventory. A poor meditation is better than no meditation. Poor prayers, short prayers, are better than no prayers. And I got a whole new rule for living. And it's much better. I mean, this is an it has really helped me do things that before I wouldn't do. I would shut down if I couldn't do it perfectly. Now, sometimes I'll go right ahead, and of course, I just profit when I do it, because I'm doing something, and something is better than nothing. There may be another series of tapes that I'll leave. They're very bad in quality. I didn't like the revised standard, but there was something on it that was real good in the original. I did a workshop for OA on the AA Big Book. And my clues were that first, every step from the third step on has some actions. So I spotlighted what are the actions. And secondly, that every step from the third step on has some prayers. And I was astounded by some of the things I found. And I came up sort of with a format for me at the start of a day to quickly do the prayers of the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and 11th. 12 steps. I want to talk about the fifth step. I was at least 12, 13 years sober, 14 when I saw this. I missed it all the time. The fifth step prayer in the Big Book is absolutely astounding. Going to share your life is not all of the fifth step in the Big Book, incidentally. The prayer is part of it. It comes after the start of five and before the start of six, so it's part of the step. And what the step says is we thank God for the privilege of having gotten to know Him better. I'd never, ever thought of a prayer like that. And as a clergyman, seeing how few sincere Christians come to an experience of God, sadly, and how almost anybody who works the program comes to that experience, I realized how really blessed we are. But as I looked at this thing, I got a real sense of how perfectly placed the prayer is, because it comes after 4 and 5. Now in 4, I do whatever I can to see who I really am. I look at me as I am. I also want to share this. Please, and I think I'll share this again tomorrow morning, don't ever join steps. 4 has nothing to do with 5, and 8 has nothing to do with 9. The worst thing you can do for 4 and 8 is to join them to the following steps. It makes them at least 5 times harder than they have to be. The whole purpose of the fourth step is for me to see me. That's its only purpose. I got to know what size I am. I'm not, like if I'm 5'10", I have to know I'm 5'10". I can never have peace if I've got to be taller or shorter, or if I think I'm taller or shorter. Supposing I'm 5'10", and I think I'm 7 foot tall, and every time I go through a door, I duck like this, because I think I'm knocking through. People will lock me up sooner or later. Supposing I'm 6'8", and think I'm 5'10", and I go through doors. You know, just... It's just going to be terrible the whole way through.
Ken told me these. We have a little bit of Al-Anon, and you know what the Al-Anon handshake is? For those who are listening to the tape only, that's wagging your finger at somebody else. And the Al-Anon salute. Okay, hand to the forehead. Now, the other one I came up with, the Al-Anon anthem, Coda anthem. Feeling all those pressures. And after I came up with this, they're funny to hear. They're terrible to live. But once a month, I'm walking around the rectory and I go, and now I got to stop and laugh at myself. Because it just means I'm internalizing pressures, that's all. And as soon as I see that, I laugh and the pressures are all gone. Anyway, four is me seeing me. I got to see that in order to really be me. I got to see who I am. Don't have to like what I see. I have to love it, accept that that's me. I can't have peace until I say I'm 5'10", and peace for me starts at accepting this reality. Next thing I need to be free, to be me, is to be able to be me in the world. Before I see it, now that I know who I am, I go to somebody and I share everything I am with that person and I'm affirmed. That gives me ultimately the freedom later to be me with anybody else. That's what really comes from the fifth step. I have the freedom to be me. We're going to deal with the principles tomorrow morning. I think that's the talk. I think that's when it is. I'm going to go through all the steps and talk about what I understand are the principles for each step. So if you want a good exercise even between now and then, you have some free time, ask yourself, what do you think is the principle for each step? Every time I've done it, I have different principles, so there's no right or wrong answers. And if you come up with your own list, then we can enrich each other. And if you do yours first, then you'll have a ground to kind of listen to mine, and I won't just mold you. You'll be able to do some thinking and weighing and get maybe some new insights. But now watch what happens. See, what I discovered is only after I have the freedom to be me do I give God the freedom to really be God. That's why this prayer is so perfectly placed. If I have to be perfect to accept myself and to please you, then God's perfection is God. But when I had the privilege of looking at paper at who I am and seeing all my faults and my weaknesses, going to someone else and sharing that, giving me the freedom to be me in the world, whether people like it or not, when I have the freedom now to be Larry, now God can really be the God who is. My God isn't a perfectionist. My God is merciful. To put it another way, see, if I have to be Francis of Assisi at his best, to be sober, to be loved, then that says something about God. But if I can be Larry, stealing money from the church, still charging things I shouldn't, still with some sexual problems, still with so many defects, and I'm still sober, what does that say about God? That's a whole different God, see. It's a perfectly placed prayer. Just perfectly placed. So in this whole sense of where it's flowing, I can think wrong. That's okay. I don't have to have everything thought out correctly. I don't have to be perfect. I have a God who loves me as I am. So I can use my mind and come up with wrong answers. The second thing that I think that is so important that I'd like to share with you is something that I got from Bradshaw. I don't know what's in the book. It's on his tapes. He's the only one I know that I have heard who talks about a tape. A tape meaning a message that controls our lives that many of us have, and that says that I can't be a greater success than my family. I started noticing some very strange patterns over the years in sobriety. I heard fifth steps of 5, 6, 8, maybe 12 people who, for no academic or financial reason, no good reason, would quit college their senior year. The last semester, one person, 3 credits from a degree, and never go back and get it. I know people who keep switching from job to job laterally. I sponsor a nurse, a real wonderful gal, a Native American, after I had heard this pattern. What the pattern is, it says, the reason they're doing this is there's a tape inside that they're not allowed to be a success. And so they'll come up to success and walk away, always with a conscious reason. This is where we're blind running our own lives. Always with a silly reason, never with a good reason, real to them, unreal to anybody else. And they walk away from it. They're constantly walking away from success, because inside them is a tape that says you can't be a greater success than your family. This Native American, she, single mother of four or five kids, she wanted to become an LPN. I knew nothing about her. I picked her up as a sponsoree when she was 2 or 3 years sober. She kept flunking the math test that was a prerequisite to get in the program. And in Oklahoma, the program she was in, you could flunk it four times. The fourth time, she was in the course already for a month. She passed it, barely. So I didn't know if she was a very intelligent person. All of a sudden, like almost any codependent, she's instantly leading the class. So that about a third to halfway through the program, she knew she was going to graduate. So she calls me up. And this is what she says. She says, I don't think I want to be an LPN. So I don't think I want to graduate. I'm going to quit. And my response was real, because I knew this already. My response was perfect. I says, okay, you can quit anytime you want to, 1 month after you graduated and are working as an LPN. Till then, we don't talk about it, and hung up on her. So she went through LPN school. Then, well, that wasn't good enough. She then registered to become an RN. Went to college, she's going to get a degree, full degree, and be an RN. Slaving and moaning and groaning and everything else goes through, I think it's 2 years. It's a degree program, till finally she's starting her last year. And all of a sudden, she knows she's going to make it. From the end of the last year on, she has come up with five good reasons to her, silly as anything to me, to quit college. One was she was going to switch colleges. Why? She's going to go from Cameron University to University of New Mexico. She had no reason. Couldn't come up with a reason. Second was she's going to move to California. Third, to be finances or this or that and lots of different things. And I know what's going on, and I'll bring it back to it. Hey, you won't let yourself be a success. You're afraid of being a bigger success than your family. We don't talk about it. So, you know, I've told her, you know, you can quit again anytime you want to after you get your degree. But I have also told her, it's after this damn program, if she decides to get a master's in nursing, I'm going to kill her. I don't want to go. But I mean, and then I'm watching other people. I knew somebody who heard he was going to be a tremendous success in his company. And within 2 months, he switched companies. That they had marked him to shoot up like a comet, and he switched companies. Just talked with him recently. He had no idea what was going on. And it's this, I can't be a greater success than my family. I used to confuse this with the self-destruct. So many of us have a self-destruct. It comes out clearly in drinking. It's often connected in the sexual area. But this one isn't. Since it's destructive, it's walking away from success. And we'll shoot for goals. Can't be like, they'll go to college and back away. They'll try their hardest at a job. And as soon as they know they're going to make it, switch jobs. Bradshaw mentions it on his tape. I haven't found it in the book yet. It's something that has to be countered. And one of the big ways is by giving permission to be a success. If you're here, maybe let your sponsor hear these tapes or something about it. And if you really have a loving relationship with your sponsor, when the time is right, because this is what I saw happen so profoundly 2 weeks ago, just let your sponsor look at you and say, I give you permission to be a success. You can be as successful as you can be. And I watched somebody almost melt because it was so profound for him. That's one way to get it, from a significant authority. And also from the parent in you to the child in you. But better first let it come from outside. Let your parent look at the child and give the child permission to be as successful as the child can be. This really does have a bearing on this whole area of thinking. First, I'm going to tell you to the degree you need to hear it. I really do give you my permission to think. I think your mind is just one of the most priceless things in the universe. I give you permission to find that out, and I give you permission to experiment with it, and I give you permission to think wrong. I give you full permission to make mistakes. I even give you permission to criticize my thought. Whew, that one's hard. To think wrong. I really do. I mean, I give you the permission for this. That's so important. I want to show how I consider this important religiously. And if you're not Christian, pardon this, but I want to tell you who the Pharisees are. See, we got the total wrong impression of the Pharisees. We figure that we blame them for the death of Jesus. They were the great enemies of Jesus. And so we see them as evil people. That's the exact opposite of who they were. They were the monks and the nuns of their day. They were the people in Jewish life who tried to do more than everybody else. And the word Pharisee comes from the term, they separated themselves from everybody else, the way monks and nuns do, so they could do more. The Jewish religion said fast once a year, no food from sunrise to sunset. They fasted voluntarily, no food, no water, twice a week. The Jewish religion would have basic requirements for praying. They prayed several times every day. The Jewish religion said tithe a certain amount of certain things. They tried to put a tithe on every single thing they had. They weren't being legalistic. Those are critiques we throw at them. They were trying really to be the best people they could be. What is their error? They had a box that they put God in, and they wouldn't let God fit outside that box. They weren't open. They weren't ready to think. That's all. When Jesus came with a new view of God, they said, that can't be, and they threw him out. Just ever so bad. Have it somewhere else. When I get to it, I hope I won't have to share this. Very important in my whole understanding is the parable I like to tell of the three blind men with an elephant. And if you heard it, please let me tell it again, because it helps me. It helped me become open. Three blind men had never heard anything about an elephant. No idea of what it was. They're privileged to be touring a circus, and they're allowed to come in this tent, be free. There was a very tame elephant. They said, if you've never known what an elephant is, go in and find out. And they go in, and one man walks over, and he puts his hands on the side of an elephant, and he walks out saying, an elephant's an animal like a barn door. The second man comes in, and he puts his arms around the leg of an elephant, and he walks out saying, an elephant's an animal like a tree. The third man walks out, and he puts his fingers around the tail of an elephant. He says an elephant's an animal like a snake. They're all wrong and they're all right. They're all wrong if they say this is what an elephant is. They're all right if they say this is how I experience the elephant. Now that's very good because it helped me understand what's wrong with most religions. God allows everybody to experience him. Religions are right when they say this is how we have experienced our God. They're wrong when they say this is all God can be. That our experience is all God can be. God can't fit into any box. If God is infinite, God is everything. The philosophers have said this, but we kind of forget it. Whatever you say about God, you can say the opposite. If he's everything, he's everything. So that experience is so broad and so wide. When we try to put God in boxes, God does not. My God really doesn't fit well into any box. If I had a term for him, he's constantly the God of the surprise. You go around a corner and there's a new side of God. Something new, something different. And we have to be open. That's one reason I think religion is so absolutely crucial. I'm sorry, that saying the mind is precious is so absolutely crucial. So we think, so we're open, so we can have these new experiences, so that we can share with each other. So what should be my attitude to my mind? Do I respect my mind? You know, if I've been insulted, if I've been called stupid, instinctively, it should be so difficult to have a respect for my mind. Do I feed my mind? You know, the mind needs input. It's got to eat. What do I feed it? Junk food? Do I feed it at all? Do I do any thinking, any kind of input? Watch anything that will give me new ideas, new facts? Do I read? Will I watch things that are going to feed and broaden the mind? Or, again, okay, just like as I said, these young teenagers that are old, am I only going to give the mind what conforms with what I already know? New facts, new thoughts, new conclusions just can help a mind so well. I mean, it's just, I guess this is where I know I'm very different from other people, but as I said, one of my greatest joys is when I see something new. And one of the greatest pains is if I don't have someone to share it with. I remember two Christmases ago, I just saw the Christmas gospel in such a simpler, neat way, and hurt because I couldn't think of anybody I could call up right then to share it with. The priests I know wouldn't be interested in things like this. They didn't enjoy those kind of insights, and this kind of thing just almost needs to be shared in its own way. The time I saw how all through the gospel Jesus picked love over truth just wiped me out. That was so simple and so neat and so opposite of what I had been hearing out here, but so flowing from the God that I've seen in the program. All through it, God always picks love over truth. It's okay to be wrong. Shoot for the best. Don't ever lower the goals. I need to work to see my mind as precious. And that's part of what I can do here is picture God as looking at my mind and my brains. Just picture God as kind of looking into your head and just seeing something golden with a glow coming. It's like, you know, it's your supercomputer. There isn't a computer in the world that can compare with your brain. And just watch God respect that and the great respect God has for it. And how maybe even though look God looking at your brain, and if you were called stupid, crying. Watch God cry. That's so neat. Because you don't know the value that you got. And hoping that you find this particular treasure. That God's specific invention isn't being used and valued. Okay, what do I do to help my mind grow? Again, you can think of two or three things. I read books, magazines, newspapers, spiritual things. Try new hobbies. That's so great. You know, boy, this isn't anywhere. Good thing that just hit me just now. I don't know about alcoholics. Al-Anons, ACAs, and codependents cannot play. It's play now. Let me tell you what play is by my definition. My therapist calls it something that is it's useful just by itself. Something like that. Mine is a little more shocking. Something you do alone, and I don't mean either of these. You do alone and it's wasteful. The reason I say do alone is another Native American that I sponsor, single mother with four young kids, after hounding her for months to play, said, I went playing. I took all the kids fishing. That's not play at all. That's slavery. Remember me, kick the kids, go fish. Get a babysitter. And see, then I said that's wasteful because I could picture her saying you do it alone, meaning don't take the kids. That's what I mean. You don't do it with your husband. You don't do it with your kids. You don't do it with your friends. They can do it with you. You may allow them to be with you if they don't interfere with your enjoyment. You come first in this. That's you wasteful because I could picture her going to the kitchen and say, I'm going to play. I'm going to cook, do a batch of cookies for the kids. And, you know, killing herself this way, it's a different form of servitude. I was 9 years sober before I could learn to play. See, if you don't have any rights, if you don't have a right to be, how can you waste time? I got to be productive. I got to be working. I can't just be sitting here doing nothing. Let me tell you how you will know you need play. Anybody. Anybody ever burning out in any major area of their life, in their marriage, in their work, in their program, in anything, is not play. Doesn't make any difference if it's a good reason. You can be taking care of a dying parent. But if you don't play, you're going to burn out. If I have a good reason to put the lights of my car on and or a bad reason, and the car isn't going, it won't make any difference. The battery's going to run down. Anyone not playing will burn out. And it's just terrible to try to get people to play. Now, I really didn't know how to get women to play. I had this gal that I sponsored. Tell her to play, play, play. And she screamed at me once, how do I play? And I didn't know. And I found out my error. First thing I tell her to do is go get a teddy bear now. See, I was trying to think, how do you get a woman to play? And I forgot that's not how I play. We're all frustrated as little kids. You know, we were the saddest thing, isn't he a good little adult? And I was. I was my mother's dad. I took care of her. I protected her from my father. I never was a kid. And my mother's fear-filled. Her philosophy of life was save for a rainy day. Behind every sun is a cloud hiding and you're going to get rained on. Never enjoy anything. Save it because you're going to need it for later. So don't ever enjoy life. Don't ever risk anything. There can always be a million things go wrong. Don't climb trees because you can fall. Don't skate because you can hurt yourself. Don't bike fast because you can have an accident. And then I get sober and I start playing and I start skiing. And Chip's the one that did it. I'm skiing. This is my ability. This is dangerous. This is safe. I'm skiing back here, having a good time playing. And all of a sudden, I start skiing with Chip. And we're at a place called Keystone. And Chip is just a tremendous skier, if you know Chip. Tremendous skier, smooth as anything. And we're going down. He does not. That isn't skiing to me. Skiing is skiing. There's an art to it. And we're whipping by him. He's whipping by everybody. And I'm saying nobody's coming close to him. Zipping by everybody. He's crazy going so fast. Until it occurred to me at the bottom of the mountain, I stayed the same distance behind him all the way down. And I didn't feel I was going fast at all. And now I see what I'm doing now, and I'm doing that in bicycling. I drive Oklahoma roads 90, 100 miles an hour when there's nobody around. I'll just hit a cow or a mosquito. But see, what I'm doing, I know what I'm doing. I'm going for the excitement that a kid has between a guy. The ages of 3, 7, and 9, they go for the thrill of it. I was never allowed to do that, and I'm going for the thrill of it. Once I saw that, I realized what my error was with the gals. I still don't know how to tell a girl to play, but I was trying to get her to play as a woman. She's got to play as a girl. If you don't have a teddy bear, get a teddy bear, unless you have a doll, and the doll does it. But start with a teddy bear. Go looking. You deserve it. Go shopping for your teddy bear. That's the single second most important thing if you're a single most important thing, probably, if you're a woman, you're going to hear here, if you don't know it. But I think most of you are into the teddy bear therapy. Let it ride with you. Name it. A lot of men don't need teddy bears, I have heard. I certainly don't. I was thinking about this when I heard how important the teddy bear was, and I figured that I couldn't really understand how a woman would need a teddy bear. And I happened to look. I have 3 little lap dogs, and one of them was standing on my lap, wagging his little tail, and it occurred to me, I got a living teddy bear. And my dogs fill that role for me. They're very, very important. Very, very, very important. I can grieve when something happens to a dog very badly. Like a little kid crying. I just don't understand this. And it's a lot of pain. And that's okay. And if adults don't understand at a meeting even, or young other kids, how much I'm hurting over this, that's okay. I have a right to hurt over this because it was very important for me. But the play is so crucial. And what this is where I have to walk through, take the action regardless of the feeling. Because almost everyone I know feels horrible when they try to play. I'm so blessed. I go on now 5 ski vacations a year. And they're almost all a week. And I don't take my parish with me or my program with me. In the sense that unless somebody is in a true crisis, I will spend a whole week and never think of Sterling, Oklahoma. And that's wonderful. A lot of priests I know never go on vacation. They just transplant their parish. They go somewhere and they're worrying and they're calling. None of that for me. Nothing. And the people know that I believe it's important I come back. I always look forward to being back with them and ministering. It's just so much easier for me when I can charge the batteries and be myself again. I just can't tell you how important I think that is. So I also then list several ways. Oh, try new hobbies, new experiences, new recipes, new solutions to problems. You know, it's just so neat to see people who want to grow like this. They want to try something different. My mother laughs. I mean, my mother gets furious now. She's just so set in her ways. She lives with my sister, and if I set something new, and my mother's instant way to react to something new is, can't argue with that. Goes up in the attic. You know, she won't try anything new. I mean, it just doesn't. I mean, she's just, that's it. You laugh at it, and it's done, and it's gone. No new recipes, no new ways to do anything, no new anything. And boy, I just don't want to be like that at all. Then I can look at some of the ways that I can fail to broaden my mind. I won't do readings that'll challenge me. I won't try anything new. Or I'll accept things without thinking, from the church or the state. And then, as we try to do, I can kind of look at one thing I can do to make myself, to respect my intelligence just a little bit more. Hope you kind of feel the pattern. See, I mean, none of these are you. You're not your mind. You're not your feelings. You're not your body. But they are you. And if I cheapen any one of these, I'm cheapened. If I have that tape that says stupid, if I'm afraid to think because I might be wrong, if I'm afraid to express the thought because I might be laughed at, how terrible. How that's got to crush God. It's like, you know, you're supposed to be a piece shaped like this in the puzzle, and you don't know the values there, so you're not sharing, you're not appreciated. I won't think, I won't feel, all of this is dead. And if that's where you're at, though, know that that's okay. That's the wheat growing. But how God wants you to come to be a full person. A full you. Aware that there's a glow to your body, a glow to your feelings, a glow to your mind. Okay? See you later on this afternoon.